Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. The late American sci-fi writer Philip Dick coined this phrase in the midst of the Cold War, but nowadays it may be even more useful in cutting through the masses of propaganda or alternative worldviews. In this fast-changing world, can reality be even assessed, let alone accepted? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by S.B. Astana, a retired Major General of the Indian Army. General, it's a great honor, great pleasure for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, too, to talk to you and to your channel and to the audience who are watching us. Thank you.
Now, let's start with the subject of reality, because you recently published a very interesting article on European diplomacy platform, in which you wrote that both Ukraine and Russia are hesitating to accept the realities of war. In what way?
See, as far as this Russia-Ukraine war is concerned, it has reached a situation wherein from a frozen conflict, it's now moving on toward something called as dirty war, in a manner that you have the allegations of sabotage both sides. You also have the allegations of even going up to striking the leaderships and things like that. There are a lot of, the bounds are also getting removed slowly and slowly. But notwithstanding that, the reality is that if you take it from the NATO side, it's very difficult for US-led NATO to accept that Ukrainian territory, that is about 20-odd percent of Ukrainian territory, in addition to Crimea, would remain with Russia and they could start talking. From the Russian side, also the situation is that they feel that they have not completed all their objectives. If their objective was to have a southern corridor right up to Crimea and then thereafter to Odessa and joining Transnistria, then they have not completed their aim. And they have also not completed liberation of the entire Donbass region. So from that angle, they are also still short of objective. But the residual capability of Russia is not so much that there can be a major difference. Similarly, as far as the US-led NATO, which is supporting Ukraine, and in fact, it's a war between, Russia and US-led NATO. While the contact war can be between Russia and Ukraine, but the hybrid non-contact undeclared war in terms of political information, diplomatic and economic war is between NATO and Russia.
I think we would agree, both of us, that from the very beginning, the sides have been very vague in terms of setting their objectives, although you can sort of figure them out looking at how they move. But I think the difficulty here, for me at least, is that Russia, by and large, supports its war effort by itself. And sure, there may have been some calculations, but Russia has the capacity to adjust, whereas the other side, Ukraine and its Western sponsors, they're in a very tangled bind, and it's not always clear who's providing the resources, who is setting the objectives. The only thing that is clear is that it's the Ukrainians that are paying for this war in terms of human losses. But other than that, it's very difficult to understand who is actually in charge when it comes to the other side. What are the pitfalls of this kind of arrangement?
In my opinion, as far as the other side is concerned, it is US which is in charge. It is US-led NATO, and Russia happens to be the Ukraine happens to be the battleground, and the gun is being fired from the shoulder of Zelensky. It's as simple as that. 2021 was a time when Zelensky signed a decree that he will recapture Crimea. There was a NATO exercise which was done somewhere at that point of time. Now, obviously, if you see geographically, Black Sea is very crucial to Russia. So any threat there will certainly put Russia in a situation that it would react, and with a leader like Putin with 6,000 nuclear weapons, there is no way that he will not react. As far as Russia is concerned, there is no doubt that nobody would perhaps excuse Russia from invading a country, which is certainly not acceptable in the present day world. But at the same time, there has been a reasonable amount of provocation. And this was an avoidable war in a manner that had certain security guarantees of both sides been addressed. Perhaps there could have been no war. But then there were intentions. There is a war, there is a arms lobby on the other side, and their arms can be sold only in Europe. Unless there is a war in Europe, those arms are not sold. So there are many interests involved. And therefore, I call it as a big power contestation. It's a big power contestation. It's an extension of Cold War 1.0. Logically, Cold War 1.0 should have ended when USSR broke off. But unfortunately, it continued. Although we also know that there is a Cold War 2.0 between US and China. But unfortunately, with Biden administration, this Cold War 1.0 and 2.0 have got mixed up so badly that now USA will find some problem because their earlier teachers have also told, even Kissinger told once that don't tackle these two giants together. So mixing up of this one Cold War 1.0 and 2.0 has been bad news for the world.
Now, I want to ask you about something that you've written about Zelensky's objectives in this whole thing. And you said that with the cumulative aid of over $100 billion poured into Ukraine, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, has no choice but to continue fighting, as any compromise will jeopardize his survival. Where do you see the main threats of his survival coming from? Are they coming primarily from the domestic front, from Russia? Or could it be that he could be jeopardized by the West itself that claims to support him?
In my opinion, his survival, see, firstly, the question is, when I say survival, there is it has two elements. One is physical survival and the political survival. Now, as far as political survival is concerned, what is he fighting for, actually? The issue is, in fact, in one of the discussions which I was chairing with the Ukrainians and Russians both together, I asked them in no uncertain terms, what are you fighting for? Is NATO ready to give you a membership? The answer was that NATO is not ready to give you membership. Can they give it because of the Article 5? The answer is no. Because the article for a membership, the precondition is that the country should not be involved in any external or internal war at the time of getting the membership. So practicality is, it is unlikely that he will get a membership so soon, number one. Number two, so he's fighting for, because he should have a sovereign choice to say that I want to join NATO. If that is the reason, then that is not a valid reason to put so many people, displace so many people, have so many people killed, have the entire, perhaps the security of Europe getting onto jeopardy. So as far as he's concerned, also, we keep calling that it's a democratic choice of Ukraine to fight. The fact is that the day the war was declared, there was a martial law declared. And today, Zelensky is a martial law dictator. So he has a threat from inside. He has threat from Russia. He also has a question of survival, that his chair will not no more be there if he doesn't follow the narrative of USA. Very recently, I think a couple of days back, Blinken said in no uncertain terms that unless Russia vacates, there can be no peace talks. So all the media news and all the mediation efforts and everything is out of the window. The fact is, the basic, as unless US and Russia agree to agree, till then, there is no case of a talk or peace.
I want to ask you a historical question, because I think Russia and the West, at least in recent history, have had different approaches to their enemies. The United States and their allies, by the way, too. The United States tends to use their proxies and alienate them. That happened with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. I think that's happening with the Saudis right now, whereas the Russians they tend to follow the opposite approach. They reconciled with the Chechens, with whom we fought a bitter war, and the Chechens are now represented on the Ukrainian front lines. We also reconciled with China. We had major border disagreements after the end of the Cold War. Do you believe in the possibility of something like that happening in Ukraine, with the Ukrainians perhaps getting too much disappointed, disillusioned, or losing too much to turn away from the West, so that Russia can use this opportunity to reconcile with them in some mutually agreeable manner?
See, Ukraine has everything to lose. Let's be absolutely clear. Joe Biden will not risk, I repeat, he will not risk Washington or New York to save Ukraine. And therefore, their entire effort is to keep the war restricted to Ukraine in a manner that it can carry on till last Ukrainian standing, but no body bag of the West should be compromised. That's number one. Number two, they are also looking at a situation wherein no NATO member gets involved in the war, because that will leave USA with a very bad choice, either to ditch the NATO member and somehow compromise on Article 5 or risk Washington or New York, because you are dealing with Russia, which has certain weapons which can create havoc in USA. So therefore, this is a very big risk. So, and which this defines the outer bounds of the war. The outer bounds are USA will not risk that, as I mentioned. Russia does not have the residual capability to take on entire Ukraine. So therefore, the outer bound is that if this kind of support, Western support, continues, then in my opinion, the war will get frozen in whatever are the existing borders. It will be some territory plus minus. And I think that will be the time. Now this is, Ukrainians will try. They will certainly go for some kind of offensive. And after that, it will be proved whether the additional offensive weapons, and are they trained enough to use them or otherwise. Once some kind of results appear on ground, it would appear, I think it will be quite clear to NATO that it's a no-go kind of situation, because the professionals in NATO, including General Milley, has said in no uncertain terms that there is no silver bullet which can push out Russians from Ukraine. So if, as a professional, as a military professional, I can very much say that if Russians had occupied a viable defense line, it's very difficult for anyone launching offensive to be able to throw anybody out without an unacceptable amount of casualties. Now, that is the dilemma which the Ukrainians and the West will have to face.
We have no dilemma in front of us right now, because we definitely have to take a break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Волынь – это особая территория на Украине, территория, все время находящаяся так или иначе под контролем противоборствующих сил. К 1939 году поляки составляли примерно 15-20% населения Волыни.
Когда был атак на Союз Советский, в том же атаку również брали уже два батальона украинских националистов.
Морды массовые, подчас которых нищено цели все волынские, распочались в лютом 1943 года.
Они верили в то, что таким образом они движутся к созданию украинского государства, независимого, моноэтничного, такого, какое они хотели видеть.
Украинских националистов, то есть вообще Донцов публиковал, там же не завахаще доконать жадные сбродни на своем противнику, если того быть вымагало добро Украины. И то есть огромная просьба своей жительности.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with SB Astana, a retired Major General of the Indian Army. General, before the break, we were discussing sort of the local context for this war, but it takes a place in the context of the enormous changes that are happening in the world within the international system, both in economic domain as well as in geopolitical domain, with power and influence objectively shifting away from the West and more towards the East. Do you see any connection between this global process and the exacerbating conflict in Europe?
They are certainly connected, because the way USA mixed up Cold War 1.0 and 2.0, China gained some advantages. Now, what are these advantages? Number one, with the dependency of Russia on China has increased tremendously. So therefore, as far as China and Russia are concerned, they are much closer than what they were earlier. Secondly, there were many, even in the Middle East, things have changed in a manner that Saudi Arabia is now engaging with China in a much bigger way. Similarly, Iran is also engaging with China in a much bigger way. The kind of sanctions which were put on Russia have also given another message to the rest of the world, is that if in case of this is a kind of economic coercion, and in that economic coercion, if you have reserves only in dollars, you have a serious problem. So therefore, there is a need for de-dollarized economy, and there is a need for incentive for countries to either trade in the local currencies or perhaps designate some currencies, like BRICS is also looking at some kind of a common currency or something like that. Number two, USA's biggest strength was its stronghold on the global economic system. Now that is getting challenged, and that will get challenged as we move forward. This is the biggest, in fact, USA has lost on two counts. One is a stronger China, because China has become a little more aggressive, and also knows that the kind of involvement which USA has, it has diluted its involvement in Indo-Pacific to some extent. That's a statement of fact, although USA may deny it, but then it's a statement of fact. Also, the rest of the world is getting divided. You find the acceptability of Syria. You also find North Korea in the rival camp. So two very distinct kind of camps have appeared. That is China, Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, and maybe some other countries, Syria to add on. There is the other side also is there. And then there is a global South, which is basically troubled by the economic hangovers of this war. So they may not like to take sides, but then the problem is that they are still affected.
You mentioned BRICS, and I just came from South Africa, where the BRICS foreign ministers held their summit, and the Indian minister, Jay Shankar, had a couple of very interesting quotes. He spoke about economic cooperation that leaves too many countries at the mercy of too few, and he also said that economic decentralization is critical for political or geopolitical democratization. What do you think India finds itself in all this conflagration?
See, India is a country which is emerging as a strong economy, but at the same time, it is also values its strategic autonomy. And because of that, we would like to do things which are in the interest of people of India. And therefore, we also have a strong leadership which has withstood the pressure of both sides trying to pull us to one camp or the other. So therefore, in both cases, we are a democracy. We would like to engage with the USA also, but at the same time, we have very strong linkages with Russia. And Russia has been a trusted partner. Even today, if we become self-reliant in defense production to some extent, it is kind courtesy of Russia, because they gave us the technology. When the West was actually not giving us technology, denying us technology, and on the name of democracy, they were actually giving the military hardware to the dictators on our neighborhood. So this is the kind of experience which we have gone through. So therefore, India will not be a case which will take sides and perhaps would like to look for peaceful world.
Now, General, this is a very interesting moment in time because you mentioned the West not giving you technology, but obviously, given India's significance, Western capitals, in particular Washington, are definitely stepping up their charm offensive with the goal of sort of pulling India into its own camp. And just a couple of days ago, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visited India, touting increased technology cooperation and co-production in such areas as air combat, land mobility systems, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, munitions, and undersea domain, all to provide India, quote, with access to cutting-edge technology and support India's defense modernization plan. So apparently they're willing to give you all of that. Is that enough for India to side with the Americans? And do you believe that the Americans will actually deliver on what they promise?
What you're mentioning is a work in progress because we have been negotiating with Americans earlier too. And today, the strategic need is different. Today, America wants India and India wants America because we have a common threat, and that is China. So by virtue of Chinese threat, that brings USA and India very close to each other. Secondly, this Chinese threat and the Chinese aggressiveness is also drawing some other boundaries which were or certain hesitations which the West had in giving technology to India. So that's why you would have found that we also had a number of foundation agreements on technology sharing. And thereafter, the USA has come around and they are ready to share technology. The USA has also realized one very basic fact that India's reliance on Russia was for one of the reasons because they denied technology, and that's why the reliance of India on Russia increased manifold. So unless they change their stance, they will not be able to perhaps get a strategic partner, get the value of the strategic partnership with India. And this strategic partnership is very essential because I must tell you that if you see the geography of India, as far as China is concerned, their vulnerabilities pass through with the sea lines of communication, which pass through Indian Ocean, which pass through Malacca Strait. And China is weakest in this area. China is reasonably strong to give a contestation to USA in South China Sea and Taiwan Strait, but is weakest in this area.
Coming back to the U.S. Department of Defense, in its press release, it trumpeted India's leading role as a security provider in the Indo-Pacific. And I want to ask you directly, how does India see this role? And would you like to be an American proxy against China with all that technology that they're willing to provide you with? Would you like to follow in the Ukrainian footsteps and do the bidding for the Americans in that part of the world?
The answer is clear-cut no. There is no Zelensky in India. And therefore, India will certainly chart a course for itself. And India will do everything which is in Indian interest, be it escalating a conflict, be it escalating a confrontation, be it reducing a confrontation. Because India has an absolutely different situation. And let me say it in no uncertain terms and absolute point blank answer. India is the only country in the world which has two belligerent nuclear neighbors. With both of them, we have unsettled border. No other country, including United States or anybody, has this kind of situation in front of it. And therefore, the course adopted by India will be in a manner which suits Indian interest best. We will certainly not be a proxy, but certainly we are a strategic partner of USA, and we would like to get maximum support of USA in a common goal of, shall I say, of controlling China when it extends beyond a point as far as when it becomes a threat to the rule-based order or to free and open Indo-Pacific. Now, this is something which we will, the fact that we are doing Malabar exercises, that means intention is there. And although we have Quad, Quad is not a military organization, it's not a military intent. But then if you have four navies which are interoperable, and if the Chinese misbehave beyond a point, that is beyond a tolerance of all of us, then maybe the intentions can change overnight if you have interoperability.
And General, that leads us to my last question. One of the things I often hear from political scientists these days, at least here in Russia, if Saudi Arabia and Iran were able to overcome their difficulties and come to the negotiating table, why can't India and China, given the significance of these countries? And this is the question I want to address to you. Why can't India and China find a more mutually beneficial and synergetic way of relating to each other?
Okay. Very interesting question. It's a complex question. It's not easily understood by the global players. Let me tell you in no uncertain terms. Their positions on the borders have hardened beyond a point. China had border dispute with 14 countries. It resolved with 12 of them. Only India and Bhutan are left. The situation is that so many rounds of talks have taken place. In both cases, the political cost of giving anything is far too heavy in Indian side as well as on Chinese side. The situation has been that both sides on the negotiation table, they want that the other side should concede everything what they say, and nobody is ready to shift its goalpost. So therefore, it has become quite, and both have various segments of history which support their claim. So therefore, a situation has arisen wherein we have gone into for a line of actual control, and we had certain border peace and tranquility agreement, and we had certain border management kind of system. China violated all of that in 2020 and went in for the movements in Galwan and got the first mover advantage, and India also responded accordingly. So we also did some kind of quid pro quo to force them to pull out from certain areas. We have not pulled out from all areas, but then the fact is that they did pull out from certain areas. So these are two strong countries, and both of them have very hardened positions. So in the near future, although talks are on, we are hopeful, maybe in 1959-1960 there was a situation when they were talking of some kind of swap, but then that swap option is no more available because China is already occupying some of the Indian territories in terms of Aksai chain. So this is a very complex situation. In fact, one of the Chinese leaders, Deng Xiaoping, said, "It's beyond me. Let the future generation be more intelligent and let them resolve."
Absolutely. But General, you know, the world is changing fast. And if China is truly believing in the multipolar world, if it wants to develop on its own terms, it would understand that without India, this multipolar world would not be multipolar. So there is an additional incentive that the new reality that has is already shaping on, I think, there. Okay. Anyway, we have to leave it.
A quick response to that. China is into charm offensive. What they say and what they actually mean are two different things. They are not looking at multipolar world. They are looking at a China-centric Asia with India pegged at number two position, number one. And as far as global issue is concerned, they will keep saying multipolar world, but they want to dislodge USA from superpower status by 2049. That's the goal. They will look for a bipolar world till then, maybe in near term, and subsequently look for dislodging United States from number one position. That is their aim, which is well documented. So I don't visualize that they will keep saying multipolar world because they are also into...
Regardless of what they're saying, the world is indeed multipolar. I mean, there are many other countries, big and small, that want to live out their own destiny. So big nations will have to come to terms with that one way or another. Let's hope that it's not through a major war. But we have to leave it there, General. It's been great pleasure for me talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you and your channel. And thank you so much for your listeners also, for a patient listening.
Thank you for watching, and hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.